Welcome to SCOTUS-Cast. On June 26, 2008, the Supreme Court decided the District of Columbia v. Heller case. The decision in striking down the D.C. gun ban held that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to possess a firearm unconnected with service in a militia and to use that arm for traditionally lawful purposes, such as self-defense within the home. C. Kevin Marshall, of Counsel at Jones Day, discusses the case. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Marshall.
On June 26th, the U.S. Supreme Court, for the first time, struck down a law for violating the Constitution's Second Amendment, which protects the right of the people to keep and bear arms. In District of Columbia v. Heller, its last decision of the 2007 term, the court held 5-4 that the District of Columbia's ban on handgun possession in the home violates the Second Amendment, as does its prohibition against making a firearm in the home operable for immediate self-defense. The court thus at last joined a debate about the meaning of the amendment that has raged for 30 years. Both presidential candidates immediately issued statements. Senator McCain applauded the decision, noted that he had joined a congressional amicus brief supporting Heller's challenge, but that Senator Obama had not, and predicted that the handgun ban in Obama's hometown of Chicago would fall next. Senator Obama declared that he has always believed that the Second Amendment protects the rights of individuals to bear arms and claimed that the court had endorsed that view, but he avoided approving the court's holding and suggested that he continues to believe Chicago's handgun ban is constitutional. The court's one-vote majority consisted of both of President Bush's appointees, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito, along with Justice Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas. Dissenting were both of President Clinton's appointees, Justices Ginsburg and Breyer, along with Justices Stevens and Souter. Justice Scalia wrote the epic 64-page majority opinion. It is remarkable that his majority was unqualified, with no concurrences or quibbles. Also remarkable is the way he navigated the legal question. His opinion, besides having his usual clarity and flair, complete with references to Alice in Wonderland, offers a model for how a judge who is bound to the original public meaning of a law approaches a case. Heller is actually Scalia's second such opinion in a week. In Giles v. California, he obtained a majority for a similar approach in reversing a conviction as violating a defendant's Sixth Amendment right to confront the witnesses against him. Justice Scalia began his analysis in Heller with a detailed discussion of the amendment's text, exploring the original meaning of each of its words and phrases on their own, in comparison to other parts of the Constitution, and in a historical context that included a 100-year-old and hard-won English right to keep and bear arms for individual self-defense. Even his interpretive rule for resolving the relationship between the amendment's operative text, which I quoted at the beginning, and its preparatory clause praising a well-regulated militia as necessary to the security of a free state, came from the founding era, particularly a key English case from 1716. From this 25-page inquiry, Justice Scalia concluded that the Second Amendment secures a right of individuals to keep and bear arms without regard to service in any militia. The core is keeping and bearing arms for individual self-defense. The prefatory clause just states one reason for securing such a right, that it would bar a means by which tyrants had eliminated citizen militias, which the founders thought essential to freedom. Scalia then turned to other historical material to test and confirm this conclusion. Analogous provisions in state constitutions near the founding, the amendment's drafting history, and a march to the amendment's first century, considering early commentators, cases before the Civil War, Reconstruction, and post-Civil War commentators. Only after all of this did Scalia, on page 47, consider the Supreme Court's precedent, and then just to check whether they might foreclose the original meaning. He concluded that they did not. He gave extended attention to the court's Delphic 1939 decision in United States v. Miller, which declined to find that a sawed-off shotgun was a protected arm, and which Justice Stevens made a primary authority in his dissent. In Scalia's view, Miller merely established that the Second Amendment does not extend to all weapons, which actually suggested an individual right view. Scalia responded to Stevens with scorn, arguing, among other things, that Miller offered, quote, not a word about the history of the Second Amendment. This is the mighty rock upon which the dissent rests its case. In applying the amendment to the District of Columbia's laws, Scalia emphasized that the inherent right of self-defense has been central to the Second Amendment right. Yet the district prohibited an entire class of arms, handguns, which Americans overwhelmingly chose for self-defense, and its ban covered the home, where the need for defense of self, family, and property is most acute. Such a ban lacked historical precedent. Courts had struck down two somewhat analogous statutes in the 1800s. The amendment also necessarily required that citizens be free to use their protected arms for the core lawful purpose of self-defense. That made unconstitutional the district's additional requirement that firearms in the home always be inoperable. The four dissenting justices divided their objections into two opinions, both of which they all joined. Justice Stevens claimed to believe in an individual right, but argued that the Second Amendment only protects possessing and using firearms in connection with service to a state-organized militia. Notwithstanding, as Justice Scalia remarked, the oddity of citizens having a right to use a gun in an organization from which Congress has plenary authority to exclude them. In Stevens' view, the amendment says nothing about private civilian uses of firearms, particularly not the English self-defense right. Stevens began and ended with Miller. In between, he argued on textual and historical grounds, particularly the amendment's drafting history, that Miller, as he read it, had accurately captured the Second Amendment's meaning. Justice Breyer's dissent argued that the district's handgun ban was constitutional even if the Second Amendment protected a right of individuals without regard to militia service. He pointed to urban regulations involving firearms from the founding era, and then, for 28 pages, waded through the contemporary policy arguments for and against the district's law, ultimately concluding that the arguments for it were sufficient. Justice Scalia dismissed Breyer's founding era examples as marginal, because most involved fire control measures for storing excess gunpowder, or just restricted the firing of guns in cities. He dismissed the rest of Breyer's opinion as judicial lawmaking. Justice Scalia salted his detailed originalist analysis with general discussions of constitutional interpretation, usually in response to the dissents. To Justice Stevens' reliance on lower courts' long-standing interpretation of Miller, Scalia responded that their erroneous reliance upon an uncontested and virtually unreasoned case cannot nullify the reliance of millions of Americans, as our historical analysis has shown, upon the true meaning of the right to keep and bear arms. He was applying the rule with which he had begun the opinion, that the Constitution was written to be understood by the voters, and therefore its words and phrases should be understood in their normal and ordinary meaning of the time, not in some secret or technical sense. To Justice Stevens' reliance on the amendment's drafting history, Scalia responded not only on the merits, but also by cautioning that it is dubious to rely on such history to interpret a text that was widely understood to codify a pre-existing right. To Stevens' disparagement of Scalia's reliance on cases and commentators from the 1800s as post-enactment legislative history, Scalia pointed out that he was not trying to retroactively read legislators' minds, but rather was seeking the public understanding of a legal text in the period after its enactment or ratification, which he thought a critical tool of constitutional interpretation. A stark example of the interpretive gulf between the majority and dissent is that Scalia invoked the constitutional commentary of St. George Tucker, widely read and respected in the early 1800s, to which Stevens responded with allegedly contrary views in Tucker's unpublished notes. Scalia similarly concluded his opinion for the court by acknowledging the policy arguments in favor of the district's laws, arguments Breyer had made primary, but rejecting them as irrelevant. Scalia explained that the enshrinement of constitutional rights necessarily takes certain policy choices off the table, and that, whatever the merits of gun control, it was not the role of this court to pronounce the Second Amendment extinct because of them. The court's opinion in Heller is also notable for what it did not do. It did not establish an overarching level of scrutiny or standard of review for assessing Second Amendment questions, except to reject rational basis review as making the amendment superfluous and as inappropriate for rights that the Constitution expressly protects, and to reject Justice Breyer's nuanced balancing of interests as subjecting such rights to the whim of judges as to whether the right is really worth insisting upon. The Department of Justice in a widely derided amicus brief, had urged the court to create a novel level of scrutiny and remand. But Scalia did not even cite the department's brief. Scalia also barely paused over the district's argument that it could ban handguns because it allows ownership of rifles and shotguns. The court thought it enough to conclude that the amendment protects weapons in common use by private citizens for lawful purposes like self-defense, that the handgun is the quintessential firearm of this sort, and that the amendment at least bars a complete ban on such an arm. The court's opinion thus leaves many questions to be hashed out. First is likely to be incorporation. The court did not need to, and did not, answer whether the right applies to the states through the 14th Amendment. But Justice Scalia seemed to go out of his way to lay the foundation for incorporation. Among other things, he highlighted the ways in which blacks have been stripped of the right, and recounted Congress's zeal to protect them immediately after the Civil War. Lower courts may punt the question to the court, but it is difficult to see how the court could decline to find incorporation, absent a surprise arising from a change in personnel. The court also, by its own admission, left unresolved many details of the scope of the right. As to which arms are protected, Justice Scalia did apply the general rule I noted, and added conversely that the amendment does not protect those weapons not typically possessed by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes. This rule led it to indicate that restrictions on machine guns and other military firearms are safe, as is Miller's holding regarding short-barreled shotguns. As to keeping arms, the court stated that long-standing prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill are presumptively lawful, but this is dicta, for which the court admitted it had not provided extensive historical justification. One can therefore expect that, especially if the Second Amendment is incorporated, the margins of these two prohibitions and the substance of others will be probed. D.C.'s licensing requirements also were not directly at issue, so questions of licensing and registration remain open. Guided by Scalia's opinion, litigants and courts presumably will at least begin by looking for historical analogies. As to bearing arms, the court noted a string of cases in the 1800s upholding bans on carrying weapons concealed. It added that forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places, such as schools and government buildings, also is presumptively lawful. Justice Scalia did in his historical analysis repeatedly indicate that bearing arms includes individuals carrying them openly for self-defense. He did not discuss the common law rule against carrying so as to terrify people. The irony is that many states have in recent years become more open to allowing concealed carry than to having arms borne openly in the streets. How this preference will interact with the history and what compromises courts might allow is anyone's guess. Thus, although the court has at last addressed and perhaps resolved the long-disputed foundational question about the Second Amendment, it has hardly left scholars, litigants, and lower courts with nothing to do.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.